Hi, it's Dave. Today, I'm joined with Ross Gerber, the founder and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. Over the years, he's been an advocate of Tesla on Twitter and in the media. And I want to welcome you, Ross. Thanks for joining.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah. It's been a crazy year for Tesla, I'm sure for you, but also for all Tesla shareholders. What do you make of this? I mean, Tesla's at, what, $640-something as of today. It's been going crazy.
I mean, honestly, it's obviously better than I expected, but it's nice to see the market recognizing what has been built at Tesla over the last several years and the accomplishments that Tesla and Elon Musk have made in transforming transportation and energy. And so I don't actually look at it that crazy. I actually think the stock has done obviously exceptionally well, but I think it deserves to be where it's at.
Yeah. I mean, going forward, though, I mean, the stock just what it did a crazy, what, 10x, if not 15x or something 10X, crazy, right? Yeah. Over the past year and a half. Where can it go? I mean, do you see this actually stabilizing and, you know, or do you see a lot of volatility going forward? And does like the S&P 500, do you think it changes any of the volatility kind of projection going forward for Tesla?
Yeah. I mean, it's great to be in the S&P 500 to cut volatility because you have so many funds that are passive indexes that will now just have to buy Tesla. They own Tesla. Every time somebody buys an S&P 500 fund, it means they're going to be a buyer of Tesla. And so so much flow just goes into the index because so many advisors in my industry don't actually pick stocks or don't actually do investing. They just do asset allocation into these broad indexes. So it's a huge plus for stabilizing Tesla stock. Now, what happens with stocks that make big runs is they reach a point where they're is enough sellers for buyers. And so it stabilizes in a price range. And then it usually tests a sort of lower, you know, band and then an upper band. And we really haven't found that yet with Tesla. And then it'll usually base, and it could be for years, where the stock will bounce in a range here, let's say between $400 and $800 billion, as Tesla sort of proves to the street all the expectations, and then they achieve those expectations. So as an investor in Tesla, I would say you have to be a long-term investor. All the investors I deal with in Tesla are long-term investors, including myself. And I think over the next 10 years, investors will be incredibly well-served in Tesla. But I think right now, you have to be very careful being a buyer and buy a little at a time and take advantage of dips in the stock if you're interested in being a Tesla owner.
Yeah, I'm wondering, do you think like the whole S&P 500 inclusion, how big of a difference does it make in the psychology of traditional, let's say, investors and Wall Street, where now you can say, hey, Tesla's an S&P 500 company. Like, it's not just this scrappy, you know, California startup, but it's like legit. Does that make a difference, you think, in people's minds?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it is a legitimization of their success as one of the top companies in the world. But I think even more so, as a fund manager, then it puts you in pressure because everybody wants to compare to the S&P. So they say, how'd you do against the S&P? Well, if you don't own Tesla and you're vastly underperforming the S&P, let's say over the next year, then your clients are going to say, you're not capable because I'm better off in an index fund. And now you're trailing because you don't own one of the most exciting growth companies in America. So it forces investors to buy the stock, just like investors own Apple, whether they like Apple or not, because if they don't, they'll trail the index and most likely will trail the index.
Yeah.
And so if you're a big component in the S&P, in a way, good fund managers will just own you because they just can't have too much tracking error in their funds compared to the S&P.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I'm curious. I want to ask you this. So Tesla's gone from, let's say, pre-split price of like 178 at the low of last year. And now it's at pre-split price of like $3,200. Okay. Actually, yeah, that's crazy.
Right.
Post-split, it's about 640-ish or so. I'm wondering, though, at what price do you, as an investor, say, hey, man, this is pretty frothy. I'm going to take off half off the table. Like, this is just, I'll wait it out.
I rarely make such absolute decisions like selling half of a position because it has a lot of repercussions because we manage a lot of money, including tax repercussions. So it has to be a really, really compelling reason to take that much off the table and pay taxes on it. So I kind of look at it like Tesla's been overvalued. You know, I would argue it's probably trading at twice what it's worth. in my mind, but I use traditional valuation methods, not the current stock market bad method. So I have sold stock in Tesla. I've sold it many times. I still sell it almost every day because we have so much Tesla. And so as Tesla goes higher, I have to sell as a prudent investor. Many of my clients are older and they're not going to be here for 10 years to see the 10-year outcome. You know, if you're a 75-year-old investor, you know, does it make sense to think about 10 years from now when you may or may not be there? So we trim in Tesla now. And if, you know, you have an oversized position, I think there's lots of other opportunities in the stock market besides Tesla. So yeah. I think prudent investors should maintain allocations that they're comfortable with. And that varies depending on many factors like your risk tolerance and age and goals, you know. So that's what you really have to take into account. But as far as a core holding of mine and will be for a long time in the future, absolutely. It's my biggest position in my firm as a stock and individually. And I think it's one of the most exciting companies in the world. But I think people have to understand stock prices can change dramatically. Just like last year, it was dramatically undervalued when everybody hated Tesla 18 months ago. Now it's dramatically overvalued and everybody loves Tesla. So, you know, I think that's the stock market and you just got to be smart about it.
I'm curious, what's your take on the stock market right now? I mean, we have some, it seems like, you know, the stock market, especially these growth stories, these tech companies, they're just going crazy. You're getting like just companies that don't have a ton of revenue are getting insane multiples. Is there some rational way to actually justify these valuations of some of these companies? And we were talking about, you know, these IPOs that will double or triple the first day, right? You have companies like QuantumScape, which just like skyrocketed the other day.
Yeah.
And they're not even...
Well, I got hammered today.
Yeah, I got hammered. Yeah. They're not even making anything right now. DoorDash, you know, Airbnb. I mean, like what's going on? I mean, how do you take it? Do you take more of a long-term view and say, hey, okay, we're cost-basing, you know, into this slowly over time? Or do you warn your clients and say, hey, you know, it could get frothy? What's your take?
Well, you got to remember, I started my career in 1994. So my first 6 years in the business were technically the frothiest market in American history besides the 20s. And at the time, I went to meetings about dot-coms that were the same thing that we're seeing today, and these companies are all gone. But there were companies like Amazon and other companies formed during those periods of time that became giants and hugely successful too. So I'm not going to say all of them are going to fail, but most of them will. And I know that's depressing to many people because they love these companies, but I compare DoorDash to HomeGrocer.com. I don't know if you remember that company. I used to love HomeGrocer. It was such a great company. They delivered food. What a great business, right? No, they went out of business. So what I feel is when an investor starts questioning their fundamental belief system because the market's become incredibly overvalued and you start buying into that, that's how you get kind of murdered. And so like my whole thing is there's value in the market. You have to find it. And there's extremely expensive companies in the market and you have to avoid them, even though you might like the names. Like Airbnb is a great name, but you know, it's like, you know, it's sort of like In-N-Out makes a great hamburger, but paying $50 for it, it's just not that good, you know? So like, that's what people are doing is they're paying $50 for In-N-Out Burger. And it's not that In-N-Out Burger isn't good. It's good, but you're just paying $50 for it. So I'm going to wait till those burgers go back to the correct price, which is, you know, a few dollars. And that's what's going to happen to all these stocks, just like the dot-coms. You know, Yahoo used to trade at $280 a share. It was like such a hot stock, you know?
I remember, yeah.
And I remember all this, like, definitely. Clear as day. You know, one of the advantages I have over other investors, especially in the markets today, is I've been trading since I was 13 years old. And so when you think, I can tell you anything about any year that's happened in the stock market since 1991 or two, you know? So like, I remember all of it very, very well, you know, any year, what stocks were good, why it was good or bad. And I can tell you from my experience in my life that valuations matter because these are real businesses with real cash. And in the end, if you buy a stock, you got to look at it as you're buying this company.
Yeah.
And if you pay this absurd price for even a great company, it doesn't mean you're going to make money.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious if you've noticed this. Like, it seems like there's a narrative going around where people are saying, hey, valuations don't matter. You know, it's that yeah. that's old school. Right now, it's just about growth and just, you know, catching these names, these companies. Are you seeing this as like a growing narrative? And does this concern you that this is like bubble territory, or we're getting into some frothy areas?
Well, it would concern me if I bought into it, right? But as an investor, the fact that other people buy into it gives me an opportunity. Maybe it's being short instead of long, even though I'm not a short seller. But I think, you know, I don't bet against markets because I think it's foolish. But I do think that pushing narratives like, you know, valuations are different now because of COVID or because technology is so great, ultimately are self-serving. And many of the people pushing those narratives, it's self-serving, especially if you're a VC or an IPO seller or a Wall Street firm. Why would you push overpriced narrative when you're trying to sell people lots of IPOs? So you got to work with independent investors like me who are fiduciaries and not brokers like, you know, Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch, where they're going to tell you anything they need to sell you a product, versus fiduciaries like my firm, where we're really here to do what's best for our clients, and we work for our clients and we don't have products. So you have to take with a grain of salt, you know, what you're seeing in the media, what you see, the narratives being pushed about modern monetary theory that like somehow debt won't matter in the future, or stock prices at 400 times earnings, or let's say 30 times sales, somehow is reasonable because this is such a great company. It's not.
Mm-hmm. If you see this continue to grow in coming months, how will you change your investment kind of approach? Will you shift some of your assets and your recommendations to maybe some safer assets and wait for a correction, or kind of what's your strategy?
Well, we've been there all year. So our strategy pretty much going into COVID, I wouldn't say we predicted, we assumed that COVID would be way worse than what the government was saying at the beginning of the year. And that's because we had a lot of contacts in China. So we knew what was happening in China. And I talked about it on a couple podcasts, and we moved to conservative position. And it helped us on the downside. So we only had about half the downside as the rest of the market on the way down. Not that that was fun, but we didn't aggressively reinvest on the downside because I actually assumed the markets would be much worse and the economy would be worse. But the Fed and the stimulus package have supported the economy through this period of time. And then there has been this crazy transformation in the economy that's been hugely beneficial to certain companies as well. So then we made shifts in our investments, but we're pretty tech focused as it was. So it was like hugely beneficial, a lot of these trends towards us because we're tech investors. But we haven't change our allocation at all. Like I'm still 50% in bonds and 50% in stocks, and I'm outperforming the market by 2 times right now because of positions like Tesla and our video game positions and many of our technology companies. But I haven't changed my allocation because I'm still bearish going into the beginning of the year because of COVID. And I think, you know, the death toll is just going to be outrageous in a few weeks. And just what we're seeing around here in LA, I mean, people are getting sick left and right. Young people, tall young people, mm-hmm. who are going to parties and pretending like it's over. And Christmas is coming around the corner and millions of people are going to expose their families to COVID. So it's really going to be a tough quarter. And then I think post-inauguration, with the vaccine rollout, by the end of Q1, I think there's a huge opportunity to invest.
Got it. Awesome stuff. I want to go back into kind of your history with Tesla on Twitter. And over the years, you've kind of been in the thick of things, battling out some of the different narratives. What was kind of the tipping point? What got you kind of riled up and into the whole Twitter Tesla scene? I mean, I know it's a crazy, crazy scene. You know, you post a tweet and you've got like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of responses at missions. I mean, it could take up like so much of your day, but like, well, what was it that kind of drawed you, you know, led you into this whole thing?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is the investment side. One is just the Twitter side. You know, I've managed to attract the most crazy zealots on my Twitter feed between Tesla, you know, fans and Bitcoin fans, because, you know, I'm a supporter of cryptocurrencies, as well as now I've got these Barstool fans, you know, and it's like, you know, the Dave Portnoy thing too, where people are just insanely, you know, fans of this guy and, you know, sort of a force of his own. So the Tesla thing on Twitter was more a byproduct of seeing realities in my research on Tesla, like going to the factory, for example. Like, you know, a lot of people don't go to the factory and like demand to speak to executives and really like dig under the hood like we do with stocks. And that's why we make more money than other people, is because of the effort. It's not per se that we're smarter. I mean, there are many smart people in the markets, but we certainly work very hard to understand what's happening in businesses. And what I saw what was happening in Tesla a year or two ago was very different than what the media was saying. And what happened was I realized that there was actually a concerted effort, whether it be the oil industry or state-sponsored players that are heavily invested in oil, like Russia or Saudi Arabia, that were working very hard to put out a narrative against Tesla, to destroy Tesla for obvious economic reasons. And that's when it got personal to me, because I'm a climate change activist in my heart. You know, I live in Southern California. I live right by the beach. I love nature and environment, and I see what's happening, and climate change is affecting all of us. And so for me, Tesla is more than making money on it. It's about, you know, advancing sustainable transportation. So part of what I believe in, and my firm believes in, is if we are going to invest in an area like climate, you know, and it's going to have a big impact on society, we want to use our influence in the media to push this for society. And so when I realized how many people were really against me and attacking me viciously for being a Tesla supporter, you know, I decided I wasn't going to back down. And, you know, I'm attacked incessantly to this day by the same forces. But I wake up in the morning and now I've won. And oil stocks are down, you know, 70% this year. And last year they were down 70%. And Tesla's up hundreds of percent. And our solar stocks are up hundreds of percent. All of our clean energy has made us a ton of money. So not only we've profited greatly from this belief in protecting our environment, but we've actually are advancing this goal. And so that's why it's such a personal thing for me. So there's the stock. Yeah, okay, fine. But then there's like the issue. And I see it as one of the greatest issues that we face over the next decade, and that we win. So it was very hard for me to accept, like, I'm just going to roll over and let people bully me on Twitter because they're oil people. You know?
Yeah, got it. I've noticed in the past in some of your interviews, you're saying how, like, with your company, you've tried to reinvent kind of investment advising, and you've kind of created a lean approach with minimal people and kind of this digital office and reaching out to millennials or anyone, you know, who has small assets or big assets. How important was kind of a new way to market, a new way to give the message out? Like, how important was that? Is that to your company? Like, how do you use that for your advantage?
Well, that was actually the basis of our company from the beginning. So, you know, we actually do have a lot of people because we do believe in democratizing financial advice with humans. So we're not looking to like create a tech solution for giving the advice. We're looking at creating a tech solution for distributing the advice. And it's much different than creating, let's say, a platform with AI that could somehow guess your family and tell you what to do, because it's impossible, because every family is different and the variables are constantly changing in a family. It's really, every one of our clients is different. There's just no, and we're also in LA, so it's extremely diverse. Nobody could build an algorithm for financial planning that could take into account all the factors in a modern Los Angeles family or Californian or West Coast family. But when we started the firm, the idea was, how do we democratize financial advice? I kind of feel personally like I don't really enjoy only advising rich people. And in fact, it's probably the part of my job that's least fulfilling. Not because I like my clients and all that, but like they're already well off. And so when you make clients who are already well off more money, it's nice, but I mean, have I really like helped them? You know, maybe. But when you work with people who don't have money and they start saving money and you help them build a financial plan and buy their first home and set up accounts for their kids, and then you look back in 10 years and they call you up and they're like, man, when we were 25 or 30, you guys sat down with me. And now 10 years later, I have money and I have a house and I have a family. And I'm really glad I put this plan together when I was young, thanks to you guys. Like, we've totally helped somebody. So like, that means a lot to me. And that's why we built our Get Invested program, is that I kind of feel like no matter where you are in life, if you have money, you want to invest it, you should be able to get good advice. So how do we do this in scale is through the internet. And when we started the firm, my goal was, so I used to work at a firm. I had 15 branches and over 250 employees when the financial crisis hit. And I was like, you know, this is a nightmare. And I ended up shutting a third of them and firing, unfortunately, a lot of people because I had to survive. And after that, I was like, everything's going to be different. Nobody cares about Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. We're going to start a new firm with a new name. But what we're going to do is we're going to build this digitally, have just one office, but make it look like we're a national firm because of our website. And then I was like, let's use Facebook. So we were the first firm on Facebook, and we were part of the SEC pilot program to create rules for Facebook. And this was mostly because I just started posting on Facebook, you know, now 12 years ago, and like, the compliance people freaked out and told us we couldn't. And I said, listen, I'm going to keep doing this, so you better figure out a framework that'll work. And they were like, that's fine, we're just going to terminate you. And then the financial crisis hit and they all got terminated. Mm-hmm. So they actually had removed the compliance departments from AIG during the financial crisis because everybody got fired. And that's when I really got aggressive on Facebook, because there was nobody there to tell me no. So that went on for a couple of years, and we started GK, and nobody messed with us at the time. And then I got a call from this woman who was head of compliance at AIG. And she's like, I see what you're doing on Facebook and you can't do it. And I was like, yeah, I was just wondering how long this call would take. And she was super smart because the government had put her in, and she was one of these do-gooders who really wanted to, you know, help AIG. And I forgot who this person was, but she was great. And she said, listen, we're going to enter you into the pilot program with the SEC. We'll let you keep doing it. We want to create rules for this. Will you help us? And I was like, sure. So we created rules and things that made sense and really started posting. And we gained about 30,000 fans right off the bat with Facebook. And that was when you didn't need to advertise, and they were much more democratic platform. And then I realized from that, like, boy, you know, this whole thing could get real big just using online marketing. So then we started doing Google search ads and things like that. And just, it took me a while to kind of crack the code of getting, so it was real hard to get somebody to respond to an ad to meet with a financial advisor. It's not like selling, you know, like a beauty product or a toy or something. And so it's a service business, and selling a service on the internet isn't that easy. But we got people to do it, and we started generating leads, and we were working around a cost per lead model. And that's evolved now to where we are today. And then we became big on traditional media, and traditional media started seeing what we were doing on the internet and said, oh, we want this guy on. And we've built a big business in traditional and in social media. And I think now we're one of the biggest firms in the world in the media. And it's crazy because we're basically 35 people in Santa Monica, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's amazing. It's interesting how, you know, finance, investing, research is all being disrupted, but it's coming from all these different ways. Like, for example, ARK Invest will do it mm-hmm. with the ETF and kind of sharing their public research. Maybe you might do it in mm-hmm. kind of this investment advisor role in company, but using social media, the internet, traditional media to
yeah, and I put it all out there. Exactly. You know, like mm-hmm. other advisors don't put it all out there, you know,
yeah.
And that's kind of what ARK's doing too.
Yeah. I mean, is there, like, I noticed on some of your tweets, like, you will be like, you lay it out there, you know, you will say this company like yeah. sucks, you know, or it's going, what you right. will lay. I mean, is there any, do you have to be careful though? Or do you like navigate those rules pretty like, you know,
well,
seamlessly?
I mean, I've screwed up majorly on Twitter before. It hasn't, you know, look, I'm not perfect. I was teasing the guys in my office because of Elon's tweets. I said, see, aren't you guys happy that I'm not Elon? You know, because I can only imagine the freaking out his legal team has when he wakes up on a Saturday night at 2 a.m. starts tweeting about Bitcoin. You know what I mean? So part of it is I'm an activist. So if I own stock in your company and you're doing stupid stuff, I'm going to call it out because I own your stock. I'm the owner. So I have a platform on television and on the internet. It's for the good of the company. So if a company I own, like Apple, is just like dawdling around, not buying Peloton, and then Peloton just makes huge moves and Apple releases a crappy fitness app, I call it out because Tim Cook has missed deal after deal. I go on TV. I'm like, Tim, you know, you got to look at these companies. And he just doesn't want to run Apple the way I think Apple should be run. But I'm not selling my Apple stock. So I'm an activist this way by, you know, putting it out there. But I love Tim Cook. I mean, if I met with Tim Cook, I would say, thank you. You're a wonderful CEO. But this is what I would do. And it's the same thing. Like, I've spent some time with Bob Iger. You know, I used to run into him getting coffee on Sunday mornings. And I was like, Bob, I got to talk to you about what's going on at Disney. And this guy would like sit down and listen to me for like 20 minutes. And we had this like great conversation. I love Bob. And he's made Disney much more what I think Disney should be. So if I can push CEOs and even Elon too. I mean, I've spent a lot of time trying to help Elon, you know, be better at communicating what Tesla's goals are to the media, still spending a lot of time trying to help them with this. So there's the negative and then there's the positive. I also shout out to all the people doing great stuff. You know, I wasn't a big fan of Dave Portnoy, and now this guy's raising millions of dollars for small businesses, and I'll give him a shout out too. And I bought a little Penn stock because I think, you know, even though it's overpriced, I think this guy's kind of a force to be reckoned with. And you know, look, I'll say, look, this is great. Here's a guy in the media who's using his power to try to do some good. And, you know, I used to think he was just a total a-hole. So, you know, so I'll say both sides. I'll say both sides. But I very much feel that nor do I think people should listen to me if they don't like what I'm saying. You know, it's like, if you don't like what I'm saying, don't follow me, you know, it is what it is.
I want to ask you a bit about this whole activist idea where,
right,
let's say in a new age of the internet and social media, of influencers, Twitter, YouTube, et cetera, there seems to be like a growing movement or potential for shareholder activism, kind of in a new way. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe before it was just with these big institutions or Wall Street who had access to management. But now it seems like shareholders can get in some ways kind of access to management through a different route, especially with companies, mm-hmm. let's say like Tesla, where Elon Musk is browsing Twitter and, you know, looking at stuff and he was replying to people. Do you think like how big of a disruption or change is this? And where is this leading? Like, do you think companies will be more open and engage their shareholders more? Or do you think more of the traditional kind of closed doors Wall Street mentality and approach will prevail in the future as well?
Wow. So what I think is that the way things are on Twitter scares the hell out of most CEOs. They're not people who think on their, you know, feet and, you know, engage customers all the time on a technology platform. They've got lawyers who are telling, you know, I got lawyers that tell me every day, well, not every day, but theoretically, most of what I do, they don't think is a good idea. And I say, you're a bunch of lawyers. You don't have any fucking money. You know, I like, trust me, if you're going to build a business, you got to do stuff outside the box. And I'm going to go on Twitter. I'm going to say whatever I want. And as long as I don't defame people, like, what's the problem? You know, so I don't think most CEOs are going to function around their legal teams and compliance teams like I would function or Elon would function. So and the second part of Twitter is most people don't actually read Twitter. Most people in America are not on Twitter, okay? Most people in America are on Instagram or Snapchat, let's say. So it's like the people on Twitter are the people who want to know what's going on for various reasons. And there is a portion of the population, especially in the media, that's on Twitter. So that's really the power of Twitter, is I have literally like every news agency in the world that follows me, and so many reporters follow me. So when I start talking about what a story is, or what they should be paying attention about, those stories oftentimes get written because I'm trying to clue people in to, here's the story, you know, like this is what's happening. Like, why would Apple say that they're building a car yesterday or 2 days ago? Apple didn't say it. It was some report that somebody said, you know what I'm saying? So it's like the way that media works. So then I put out, this is bullshit. You know, like, did Apple say this? No. Well, who at Reuters? I'm on Reuters a lot. Who at Reuters wrote this report? Who's the source? Well, we didn't get a source. Okay, so there's a ton of FUD that comes out all the time. And you know, you fight that on Twitter. So you have influence on what people see and hear in traditional media through Twitter. So I think smart businesses leverage social media correctly, and older antiquated businesses don't. And we see many, many companies with lots of room to improve the way they market and use social media.
Personally, I've been actually quite surprised at the kind of the impact of activism by Tesla shareholders. And last year when Elon Musk tweeted that, you know, he was going to take Tesla private at 420, I urgently like tweeted saying, hey, like, can you make sure you look after retail shareholders? And if you go private,
right,
like, make sure there's a way that they can transfer their shares into this private company. And Elon replied and he said, yeah, I'm going to make sure that, you know, that retail shareholders are taken care of.
I remember that.
Yeah. And then later on, he points that as one of the big reasons why it failed. He couldn't find, you know, the right way to protect and bring in retail shareholders. And so I was like, okay, that's cool. I mean, actually that's huge, because I was appreciative of being able to hold Tesla stock. Right. And then, earlier this year, there was this, in springtime, there was this case of unintended acceleration, supposedly, and it was like hitting all right. the news waves. And I quickly did a YouTube video and I laid down like kind of 5 to 10 points of why I thought this was impossible and how I thought Tesla needed to put out a blog post and squelch it immediately. Within an hour and a half of posting my video, Tesla posted a blog post with almost the exact title of my video and all of the points, like almost right. like ditto. That's and right. I was like, wow, this is like this is activism, which, and it's not so much that it's not, I don't care if it's me or someone else. It's just that it's like Tesla is like actually paying attention to this stuff, you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so I was right. kind of surprised at how much Tesla is watching
that's
this
right.
stuff.
I was surprised how much they listened to me too. Mm-hmm. You know, because I spent a lot of times behind the scene, exactly what you're talking about, where I was like, why did you guys do that? You guys really should have done this. And like a week later, they do it. And I was like, wow, they're listening to me.
Yeah.
And they fired actually all the people that had their own ideas. And they kind of just kept doing what people like us were suggesting to them. And they were seeing, I would actually argue that that's one of the reasons Tesla's successful right now, was when stuff was real bad and everybody hated Tesla and the shorts had the upper hand, you know, it felt almost like a checkmate. I spent a lot of time just trying to advise Tesla on how to deal with the media and like what Elon was doing and this and that. And they did a lot of what I asked, if not all. And
what did you ask?
There was a time. Well, you know, I'm not going to go into a lot of specifics because, you know, it is what it is. And one day when they do like a documentary, maybe I'll go into all of it. But like the bottom line is kind of, I'm a marketing and social media guy. And I felt like the message was just completely lost between Elon's pedo sure. tweets and attacks on the SEC. And that was my, when I met Elon, I was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, how does this advance sustainable transportation attacking the SEC? I'm like, you know, you're killing your own mission. You know, and he was like, you know, and the next day he tweeted more bullshit, but then like stuff changed. And so I would say that Elon and the Tesla management team is incredibly, how would I say, open to listening to its fans and its customers. Yeah. And that's why they're successful.
Yeah, I remember at Autonomy or at Autonomy Day last year, I remember. I was there as well at Autonomy Day. I remember at the end of the event, Elon Musk was kind of hanging out in the corner. And I remember you went up to Elon.
Yeah.
And this was with like about 10 or so institutional investors.
Yeah,
in
that
a
was
circle.
When I said it to him.
Yeah, exactly. I remember that. And I was like kind of next to you, a few people, for a few persons down. And from what I recollect from that conversation, was I was actually quite impressed where you're like, hey, I'm Ross Gerber. You might have seen me on Twitter. And he actually said, yeah, I saw you. I know you on Twitter. And so he was like acknowledging that. And then you basically were very forthright in saying, hey, I'm a shareholder. I care about this company. And you were laying out kind of your perspective on what you thought could be done better in terms of communication and different, parts of Tesla. And you dominated or that circle.
At Capital.
There's like 10
Yeah.
institutional
Well,
investors.
I was on a mission
Yeah,
too.
you
I was on
were.
a mission.
Yeah, and that struck me as first you're unapologetically like just forthright saying, hey, this matters to me, and you're taking the opportunity to share your opinions, whether or not, let's say the CEO listens or not. But it strikes me as, and you're using also the leverage that you formed on Twitter and traditional media to say, hey, and it struck me as like, wow, this is it's kind of interesting. I was actually quite impressed by your interaction with Elon. I thought
Thank you.
I thought that it was helpful to him too, because he probably doesn't get a chance to interact that much at length with just regular folk outside of Tesla, just like with people who know the mainstream. But when he has a chance to, that's pretty valuable stuff.
Yeah, that day I was on a mission because it was a real dark time and I had an opportunity to talk to him, so I was like, I got to take this opportunity. And I was actually standing there with, I think it was Gally and Trisha from ARK, and Gene Munster was there, I think. And I was like, so my biggest challenge was like, how do I get through to the guy without him just like being like, oh, leave me alone, but what impressed me about Elon, because I was kind of like, hopefully he'll respect me like sort of as an equal, because it's like I'm trying to give him advice, but I'm not trying to tell him what to do. You know what I mean? Like, he's a very successful guy. I have a tremendous respect for him, but I'm trying to help too, but I have to get through to this guy because he's causing a lot of pain. And my main mission was to get him to be more cognizant of what he was tweeting because of the damage he was causing to the shareholders like myself. And secondly, that Tesla needed capital, and having just $2 billion on the books at that point was making us extremely nervous that the shorts could end up causing some sort of drama that would then, they would get stuck, because that's the way Wall Street works. They try to, back you into a bankruptcy and then just kill you, And so I didn't want Elon to, not play his cards right and then end up getting checkmated. So, or pieces, right? And literally he sat there and he was like, cool, And he like has this look like,
Yeah, I
okay,
remember that.
I'll listen to you. And I was like, wow, okay, good. He didn't like, like get mad at me. But I don't think a lot of people around Elon are just like straight up with him. Now, fortunately, I work with a lot of like very big ego, successful people, and like I get that, but I also have a big ego too. And so it's like, I'll treat you as an equal, but I'm not like some underling that's here to just like tell you how great you are, And I think he appreciated that, and in the sense of like I was just trying to be real with him, and he was happy about that, and we had a good talk. And like the next day, this is the crazy thing, was the next day they had the capital raise. And I was like, that fucking guy, he knew the whole time he was going to raise capital. And Gene and I are like, you need to raise capital, you really should raise capital. And he was probably laughing, like, this is already a done deal, And he raised capital the next day, and we bought the heck out of this convertible bond offering, because I was like, this guy, he's so smart, he gets it. So we bought the heck out of this convertible bond. It was like 2%, and it converted at like $300 a share pre-split. And I was like, this is such a good deal. The stock was at like 240 at the time, and I put millions into this thing, and it was probably one of the best trades of my life, for my clients and myself. And so, every time I have doubts about Elon, he like always, he's got some like rabbit up his sleeve. That's such an Elon,
I remember actually you were telling him, how they needed to raise money, and he was like, he has this thing, pretty intently. I totally remember that scene there. Why do you think it took so long for Elon to and Tesla to raise money? Because in 2018, they're going through this, ramp challenge, and they had some, there were concerns of liquidity, kind of a cash crunch, especially toward the end of the year. And they could have just raised, a billion or so, or 2 billion to really help the situation. Do you think it was just Elon trying to buckle in and say, we're gonna make it without raising cash, against all odds? Or was there some other issues at hand, you think?
So the way Wall Street works is, let's say you're running your company and you need money. You need money. It's kind of like when you go to a bank and you need money. They go, okay, you can have money at 13%, And you're like, thanks, dude. Like, that doesn't help me. But then you have like companies like Apple or something where they don't need money at all. They're just putting debt on the books to buy back stock. And they'll say, oh, we'll give it to you at 1%. No problem. How much do you want? So the way Wall Street works is, when they know that you need money, they want it, they'll break your back. And like, that's the way it works. And so I don't think Elon was getting good terms for Tesla. He doesn't want to dilute his stake, because he hedged all his convertible bond offerings like a smart person. And so it's like, I would just say that he probably just couldn't get good terms on money during the harder times. And like, even that convertible bond was like hugely generous deal by my perception. That's why we bought it. And fortunately, he hedged it all with I think the way they hedge that, because they have to, dilute the stock, is they basically hedge selling the stock as people sort of buy it, so that if the stock does soar, it was Morgan Stanley or whoever is on the hook for the difference in stock price, not Tesla, diluting its, stock at a reasonably really cheap price. So essentially, like, I think Elon has played Wall Street pretty well. And so I think he also is like a race car driver. So Elon is a race car driver, CEO, and that's the person who drives full speed. He's making the turns. He's a great driver, but when there's a mistake, it's a horrible crash. It's like a gnarly crash. He's going full speed. And that's how Tesla was run up until recently. And now that Tesla's been successful, Elon has taken the opportunity to raise $10 billion this year in almost free money at the top for Tesla, and has now solidified Tesla's future. And I'm just super happy about it. So he was able to end up getting the majority of capital that Tesla has right now at almost like free money. So he understands capital markets really well. I mean, as a guy who was involved with PayPal, he gets finance, and he's worked Wall Street as well as possible, I think.
Yeah, it seemed like he was hoping that with Autonomy Day and the whole, 2019, that he could maybe raise funds at a slightly higher price, because it was like, I think, mid 200s by the time they raised funds. But I think
Right, it was 240.
he was just kind of forced to do it because, hey, they had to get through. But it was, again,
Oh, they needed
generous
that
choice.
money.
They needed the
They
money.
needed it.
I'm curious, with Tesla and, let's say, raising money going forward, do you think one of the risks with Tesla is kind of this Elon Musk in the race car going full speed? And if he crashes in a corner, let's say it's too aggressive with the machine that makes the machine, the dreadnought, a machine, where it's just so complicated that it threatens the entire Model 3
Right.
production ramp, right? And the vitality of the company. I mean, that was in Model 3. With Model X, you had this crazy, complex
Right.
Falcon wing doors. Going
Right.
forward, would
I
you
mean, the
say?
Model S had all the roofs that didn't work. Model S had all these problems too.
I
They had to
mean,
fix like every Model S when they were going to do.
especially those door handles. But do you think one of the biggest risks for Tesla going forward is that type of, like, it would probably be a different mistake, obviously, but that type of like going full speed ahead, and it has to work out in order for it to work out. Would you say that that's something we should at least keep our eyes open as Tesla shareholders?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you drive the race car real fast, you win races. You win races, but you crash too sometimes. And what Elon, the mistake I made with Elon and Tesla stock was, after Model X, I thought Model 3 would be a simple launch. Like, didn't they learn their lesson? Like, I thought they learned their lesson after Model X. So I was pretty confident that Model 3 launch would be smooth as silk. And it was a disaster with the whole robot nightmare. And really, Jerome Guillon saved Tesla and bringing in a car guy, like a manufacturing guy, or he's really a truck guy. And Jerome is still the one who's made Tesla really tick past Elon. But the problem is that I expect there to be problems with every launch of every product that they have, and investors should accept that reality. They always fix it. It works out, but it creates volatility, okay? And it creates FUD. The second thing, actually, which I'm most scared about is really the Steve Jobs thing. Steve Jobs died, and he died somewhat unnecessarily because he refused to get surgery that he needed. And when that happened, he had put in place an incredible infrastructure to keep Apple growing without him. And Tim Cook kind of took the ball and has run with it. But that was like a golden ball. Like, Steve Jobs left Apple in such a good place. It's really, I mean, it was the gift of all gifts to his friend Tim, right? But I wouldn't say the same if something happened to Elon. Like, who would run Tesla? Who's the strong number two? How would strategy be implemented? And this is my biggest criticism of Tesla right now, is you can't have a company with one guy who flies around on a private jet all day long, who does all kinds of things, and just say the entire world is going to have to rest on his survival. You know, tragedies happen. Kobe Bryant died this year. You know, if you would have told me Kobe Bryant was going to die in a helicopter accident, I would have laughed at you. I'd have said, it's crazy. It's a 0% chance. So this is a huge risk for Tesla shareholders and the Tesla company. And I think it's the most important thing Tesla does over the next year or two is develop a deep management bench in the various divisions that they have, so that Tesla could survive if something happened to Elon. Now, not to say something's going to happen, but, you know, it's a huge risk.
Yeah. Like, I think with Steve Jobs, one of the things was because his illness wasn't sudden, meaning it wasn't a sudden accident. He had a few years or several years to prepare for it. He was able to build up kind of Apple University, the whole management training within Apple, and really get his team like set up the way he wants to set up. And so he had that kind of long preparation time. I think if something happens with Elon, we probably, you know, you won't have that same type of preparation perhaps that Steve Jobs had. But on the flip side, I think with Elon, you have this super strong mission that's so specific and so clear. And that could be kind of like a guiding light, I think, for the companies, even without Elon. So I think there's definitely some trade-offs between those two. So I'm curious, I want to go back into this idea of Tesla dissolving their PR. Like, that seems like unprecedented for a company. And this is not a small cap company, right? This is a $600 billion mega cap company now, S&P 500 company, one of the largest actually in the index. But they don't have a PR department. Like, how do people contact Tesla, and, you know, like, who they deal with? Like, are you, what's your take on this?
To be honest, they call me now.
I mean, do you agree with this?
You know, no, I don't. You know, I have mixed feelings on the way Elon runs things. And I would argue that his emotional intelligence is much lower than his actual IQ, because he oftentimes just disregards things when they're not working for him, and then values them at zero. And working with traditional media is very important and valuable, and that's why I do it. A lot of people pay attention to that, and not all reporters are FUD reporters, like, you know, this Russ Mitchell at the LA Times or whatever. So, you know, I think there are many reporters that want to write good articles about Tesla and good experiences with the vehicle, but they need the opportunity to, and that's what PR teams do. I have a PR team. I love my PR team. They work very hard to get our stories out to the media, and it's a very important part of running a business. So I don't agree with these decisions. I think Tesla should develop a deep marketing and PR bench, but I also think that Elon rightfully has the biggest Twitter following of any CEO. He can make huge waves just by tweeting something about Bitcoin in the middle of a Saturday night. He doesn't feel he needs to do that. He doesn't feel he needs to engage the media because of Twitter and the huge amount of people, whether it be myself or others, who will spread his message, his apostles, you know, spread the message. So he's just like, I don't want to deal with this anymore. You're done. That's the way he is.
Yeah.
You know, but when companies are run by engineers, I think there's certain flaws. You know, my stepfather is an engineer, and I spent a lot of time with engineers like Elon, who are highly intelligent. And it's a different type of intelligence than other types of intelligence. And engineers know this. But my type of, I would say, mental thinking as a marketing person, as an investor, is completely different than an engineer. And so that's the part that bothers me about Tesla is I think they need a CEO or a, not a CEO, you know, let's say a COO or a president who can be a Tim Cook. They need a Tim Cook, you know, which is why it's so infuriating that Tim Cook wouldn't even talk to Elon, because it would have been a great partnership between Tim Cook's operational experience and Elon's innovation. And that's what Tesla needs. They just need a Tim Cook. They need an operational guy who can run this company if anything happens to Elon and who really gets the vision. Because I think the vision is already laid out clear enough that if the right people were around him, if something ever happened, it could still happen.
Sure. I want to go back on Tim Cook for a second. But before that, this idea of PR, like I kind of see what you're saying in a bit. I feel like with Elon, with his mind and yes, an engineering kind of first principle mind, like he needs to see statistics. He needs to see return on investment. He needs to see that this PR department and working with traditional media reporters is actually worth something, worth it, versus let's say you X it all out and Tesla does fine or does better even. It's like in his mind, he's not convinced that a PR is even worth, a department is worth anything, right? And so I had this idea a couple years ago. It was that Tesla, I wrote out this kind of this long series of posts at Tesla Motors Club. And I said, for Tesla's PR department, they should focus on a program that reaches out to reporters of all the world's major media outlets, websites, et cetera. And they should invite every single reporter to their factories and give them a tour, let them have test rides, you know, show them the technology behind things, have them have some Q&A with some engineers, et cetera. Just, and bring in batches of, you know, 30, 40 reporters at a time and get them this crazy Tesla dive-in experience and get them just like amazingly sold on this company and do this like 100 times a year.
But don't you see, like Elon did that with me. That like So during, you know, the drive-in show, what was that? The shareholders meeting, the cell factory reveal.
Yeah.
That's what he did. He took me and 20 other stock guys and investment people and social media people and bloggers and showed us everything and rolled out the red carpet and then I go out and I talk about it on TV all day. So he figures, why do I need to pay PR people when Ross will just do it, you know?
Yeah, but
and I do it, you know? But I still think it's a narrow-minded approach. I agree with you. So I've been in the same debate sometimes because sometimes I get so tired of certain traditional media outlets that continue to put out FUD, or they put me on TV with FUD spewers and I'm tired of having to argue with like Gordon Johnson, who's just full of crap. It's just like, I'm tired of it. And I've slayed one after the next. And I literally debate with myself, I should just like skewer these media companies for putting these people on, but then they don't put me on. And that's what happens. And then I like, well, does it matter if I'm not on, because I'm big enough now on social media that it doesn't matter. And I can just bully my way through social media and they become stories anyways. But I haven't done that because ultimately I think there's value there in maintaining these. I literally bite my tongue daily on things I would say because I would burn my bridges with these media people. But it's like on the same respect, like I need them and they need me. And so it's kind of like, I don't know how to explain this relationship. You know, I don't know. It's just, it is what it is. The media is kind of like you feed the beast and the beast helps. If you screw the beast is bad, you know? And boy, they're still bull crapping typed about Tesla every day.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I feel like if Tesla had these groups of 30 or 40 reporters who came in and did this, you know, full day with Tesla at their factories, et cetera, and they did it 50 or 100 times a year, it would make a big difference. And also, if they did it to not just reporters, but non-traditional, let's say influencers on YouTube and Instagram.
He does do that. He does do that.
Yeah, but not just US speaking either, but there's a whole world out there, you know, who's fascinated by Tesla. And I think there's definitely, I
I
think
think they're
things.
pretty engaged with their Chinese community as well.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I think, potential for PR to be rethought, I think, in a different way, and for it to show like return on investment to Elon. But I think yeah, I don't think perhaps, you know,
If
them.
Tesla hired me to be like head of like chief marketing officer, I would do 100 things tomorrow. You know
Sure.
what I'm saying? Like, I agree with you 100%. I get the free marketing and the t Elon tweets work, and they're selling plenty of cars, but I agree 100% with you. And I think as Tesla becomes a bigger and bigger company, it's even more important to have your message on a global scale be done correctly.
Do you think Tesla should advertise or paid? Should Tesla do paid advertising?
No, I don't think they need to. So to me, it's just a demand issue. Why spend money on something you don't need to? You know, I spend a certain amount of money on advertising, like during the Laker game, for example, for name recognition, but Tesla doesn't have that problem, you know?
Interesting. You mentioned about Tim Cook. Tim Cook wouldn't take a meeting with Elon Musk. So I've been picturing this whole scenario, right? Here Elon's like desperate in the maybe first half or so, or, you know, of 2018. Model ramp is crazy, and he's looking at these numbers and he's like, "We're stuck. You know, we just can't. We're, like, it might not make. We not make. We might not be able to make it." And so he's thinking, "We need a backup plan, in case things just go further south over the next couple of months." So he says, "Okay, Apple has a lot of money. Apple has high standard for products, and you know, surely Apple would be interested in a company like Tesla, right?" And
Yeah, they got a screen in a car,
yeah,
right? You
exactly.
think
And
Apple would jump?
exactly. And they're already working on something, so why wouldn't they want the best? And so Elon is like thinking, "Okay, you know, let's talk with Tim, and you know, maybe secure some type of backup plan." He calls up Tim or his office, and Tim doesn't even want to talk with him, you know? Like, what's going through Tim Cook's mind at that moment? Like, his secretary or his, you know,
The same
assistant.
thing. Same thing when Bob Iger said, "I want to talk to you about buying Disney," and he didn't deal with that. And the same thing, I'm sure the Peloton person called, and he didn't deal with that. And I'm sure Reed Hastings called, and he didn't deal with that. So I think what Tim Cook does is he just thinks Apple can do everything better, and they just don't. They just don't do it better. And so this narrow-minded, ignorant approach to being scared to use your capital to acquire great businesses that fit the Apple model is, and that's why I tweeted this. It's Tim Cook's legacy. It will be Tim Cook's legacy. He was a great CEO who ran Steve Jobs' company as well as anybody could, but his legacy is a lack of innovation and a lack of boldness in building a future for Apple in the 20, you know, 2010 to 20, I mean the 2020 to 2030s era, you know, the next decade.
Okay, I'm going to take the other side. What do you say to people who say, "Hey, sure, on the surface, it looks like Tim Cook isn't the most aggressive, ambitious, you know, risk-taking person, but on the flip side, Tim has aggressively invested into making iOS the best platform over the years. If Tim wasn't aggressively investing in iOS, Android would have overtaken iOS. And Tim is aggressively acknowledging the potential of services and revenue, subscription services for all their ancillary services. And he's putting a ton of, you know, focus into that. And he's doing like stuff like their whole chip. You know, they've changed out their whole notebook chip to this whole M1 chip. That's fantastic, and it's a big risk in a sense because they're changing out the whole architecture of their laptops, which is probably going to show a lot of fruit over the next 5 or 10 years. And so, what would you say, like,
Agree.
what would you say to that side where it's like to those people who say, "Hey, wait, but Tim Cook is doing a lot of stuff, you know, making the right moves." How would you kind of assess all that?
Well, I agree with those you know statements. I own a lot of Apple. It's my number two position behind Tesla. I've owned it my whole life, so it's grown over many, many years, and especially the last 2 or 3 years, you know, Apple's valuation and PE ratio has doubled. So, you know, I think those moves are what's done it, but that's not revolutionary. That's evolutionary. So making a better chip than Intel isn't that hard. So they put some effort into it and they built a better chip, and I'm excited that Apple's done that. I think that their operating system, more importantly, the synergies between the products and the family sharing They hook you in and you're paying them money now every month for something. I think it's great. It's a great business and I love it. But they also have a monopoly power that they abuse, and they use that to their advantage, which maybe if there were other app stores, it wouldn't be so easy for Apple. Their cut of the app store is clearly on the way down, because 30% is outrageous, cut to demand from, especially small developers and even big ones. They're having an epic fight, like I like that, with
Yeah,
Fortnite.
that's true.
And boy, I think they lose to Fortnite, because the kids aren't giving up Fortnite. They're not giving it up. So I think this is the beginning of the cracks to this closed model that Tim's book built, that has a lot of advantages for Apple, but is not necessarily the best for its ecosystem. But it ultimately will help Apple be a better company if they open up more and are more fair to developers. So that being said, Apple's a services company, and they should focus on their services like music and Apple Pay and now Apple TV. And there's assets for sale like MGM right now that I think Apple should buy MGM for sure. And just they got tons of content for their streamers and a production house. They own James Bond. $8 billion or $6 billion is nothing for Apple. But this is what I'm talking about. Okay, they've done some cool stuff, but throw some money around, make some moves. You're Apple.
Sure.
Microsoft, they throw their money around. They'll go out and buy a video game company. They bought Minecraft. What a smart move, like the Xbox business is amazing. So, you can contrast Apple to Microsoft over the last few years, and then you look at Microsoft under the Ballmer era, and it very much reminds me of Tim Cook, although Tim's performed better than Ballmer.
Sure, definitely. With Tim, I'm wondering, what if, let's do a hypothetical scenario. What if Tesla, had further difficulties? Tim Cook took the meeting, and let's say a deal happened and Apple bought out Tesla. Like, how do you see Elon Musk working for Tim? I don't see how that works out. Does he just leave the company, go to SpaceX, or what happens in that relationship?
Okay, I'll tell you how this works. Okay,
Yeah.
so there's two types of acquisitions. So the acquisitions, let's say, like when Facebook bought Instagram or when YouTube was purchased by Google, they take over the business. You become an employee of Google, and then you just like work for Tim and Larry or whatever, or Larry and
Sergey,
Sergey.
yeah.
And so it's like, that model isn't a model that Elon would ever function. Okay. But then there's the model where you buy a business and you don't touch it. And this happens all the time, where a company will buy another company and basically they own it. But Elon and Tesla is still just Tesla. It says Tesla. It doesn't say Tesla Apple. It's still Tesla, but it's just owned by Apple. And that model could work very well. Although I do think Elon's very much motivated to make money too, from a shareholder perspective. So I do think having public stock appeals to Elon in certain ways. But I think the safety and security of having the financial picture solidified would be worth being a subsidiary of Apple in theory. But then you look at Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre came over with Beats, and they didn't last that long. They don't want to work for Tim Cook, So yeah, I think that the synergies of the personalities would have been a big issue, and I'm not per se saying that a merger would have worked, but it certainly should have been considered. I mean, I said it on TV at the time. It turns out at the same time this was going on, I was on CNBC literally saying, Tim Cook, Tesla's in trouble. Like, you should be looking at this company, and it's amazing he didn't. Once again, I think that'll be his legacy, and that he missed some of the greatest opportunities to expand Apple and their businesses, and even maybe you just take a 20% stake in Tesla. Like, he could have given Tesla 10 billion
That's true.
and just gotten some stock, and not even had an operational role, but he would have owned some of the stock.
Yeah, I
Like,
mean,
what would be the downside with that?
yeah, that probably would have been the most epic move ever if Tim Cook said, okay, Elon, here's $15 billion for 25% of your
Right.
company. Go for it, right? And
Uh-huh.
Apple owns
And we want an
25% of
exclusive
Tesla.
deal for Apple on the screen. That's what he should have done. He should
Exactly.
have said that everything goes through Apple on the screen.
Exactly. And it would just only cost Apple 15 billion bucks for 25% of Tesla. Like, what is that to Apple?
Totally. Totally.
You know,
it's like nothing. It's like pennies. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's like insane. It's like if somebody came to you and he had a great idea, and let's say you have $100, and he said, okay, it'll cost you $1 to bet on this great idea. Like, what the fuck do you care? It's $1, right? It's like, it's kind of how I invested in Bitcoin originally too. I was like, okay, I'll put $5,000 in. I'm not going to go broke if I lose $5,000, you know? And Bitcoin was like 250 bucks back then, you know? No, actually I put 2,500 in because I bought 10 Bitcoins at $250. That was like my original purchase. And I was like, what's the worst that happens? I lose 2,500 bucks. No big deal. You know what I mean? And so for Apple to bet, you know, $15 billion on Tesla would have been a no-brainer. Tesla would have had its capital run off and done amazing things. And then now Apple's looking on the hugest gain, stock gain ever, you know?
Yeah. If you had to predict...
I'm going to cry. You're going to make me cry if you keep this line of questioning.
Okay,
it's such a mistake.
No, okay. If you had to, if you had to predict what year Tesla overtakes Apple as the most valuable company in the world, what year would that be, you think? This is random, just, you know, personal opinion, obviously.
You know, I think it's going to be sooner than people. I've tweeted this. I think Tesla will pass Apple and be more valuable than Apple. And I think there'll be other companies that will be more close to Tesla in valuation that they'll have to compete with, like Microsoft and Amazon, for example. But like Apple hasn't grown revenue at all. So they can't really buy back stock anymore, as the stock price is now expensive. So its actual return on buying back stock is very low now versus when it was trading at 16 times earnings. It made a lot of sense for Apple to buy back stock. But at 35 times earnings, it's a stupid move. It just doesn't, it's a waste of money. And so like he can't just support the stock. So I think Apple is more than fairly valued at the current price, even with the iPhone 5G success that they're having right now. I think Apple's more than fairly valued. And I think Tesla is too. Tesla's a much younger company than Apple. So I would guess within 5 years, Tesla passes Apple. And it might be sooner, but it was. I definitely think within 5 years.
You mentioned how you toured the Roadrunner, the battery cell production line at Battery Day. I guess it was after the event. What can you tell us? What did you see there?
Well, I saw amazing things. To preface this, you know, I was invited to Battery Day, and I don't know anything about batteries. So, you know, I'm not a real big fan of not knowing much about batteries other than sort of the basics. Whenever I need to know something, especially something I'm not an expert in, you know, I do a lot of work trying to learn. Obviously, I can't put a lifetime of energy into understanding battery technology. But I was nice enough to be referred to a guy who is friends with Gali, who used to work at Tesla in the battery division and is this genius battery guy. And so we had lunch, and he basically taught me how batteries work and how Tesla batteries work and how the current systems work. And then basically I was like, well, what the hell am I going up there for besides just sitting in a room and being blown away by technology I don't understand? You know, and he kind of laid out, you know, here's what Tesla's trying to do. And I was like, okay, this should be interesting. So so I go up there, and now I know a little bit about batteries, and it's certainly more than most people, but certainly much less than any expert. So I was armed with just enough knowledge to understand exactly what they were doing, but much of it is sort of beyond me in the sense of how it works. But what happened was, so he starts walking me through this this group of investors through this battery factory, and I felt like it was like Willy Wonka and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mm. It's like his whiz bang factory, you know, and they look like little like cans of Coke kind of thing, and it's just like shooting down this line, and I thought, wow, this is really cool, you know, they're just these cans of Coke just getting shot down the line. And then he took us to each station. They were showing what was happening at each station and how the batteries were being made, why they're different, and why they're just amazingly better. So basically what Tesla did was they took each stage of the battery creation process and rethought and redid it from like the actual raw materials to the final packing into the car has been completely redone. So what blew my mind, firstly, was that this was all going on and nobody had said anything about it. Mm-hmm. Like that, I had no idea this plant even existed. So it was kind of like, wow, they have a sell plan here, like at Fremont, like where is this thing hiding? And they like kind of took us around the corner and they're like, yeah, it's been hiding here in this nondescript, building is actually incredible technology being built. But it was basically all the Maxwell people, like when they acquired the Maxwell technologies and they built in, sort of the battery expertise that was already existing there and then added on top of it. And so basically I got to see what was happening and what I saw there was that the improvements in battery technology are going to be so huge from these innovations that Tesla's competitive position will now be, I love this term that Elon used, an order of magnitude larger than it was if they were still using 2170 cells and such. So what he basically told me that day was that even if Tesla does everything right and the batteries work and such, it's just a dent in the market for battery technology needs, like for solar storage and such, as well as to reach the EV capacity needs to sell, let's say, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million EVs a year between all the companies in the world. The batteries are going to have to just get way better and the technology is going to have to get way better, or else we can't even really serve that goal. It's just not a realistic goal. So the amazing thing after leaving Battery Day is then I started tweeting about it. I started writing about it. I started telling people about it. And that's obviously what they wanted. And then many of the people just immediately dismiss all this stuff, just like they have in the past. Now, it's like infuriating to me. I'm like, I'm not making stuff up. I'm telling you what I saw. And it's crazy because you can still go on TV and people will be like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, no. The next decade isn't going to be about making a cell phone faster or making a computer chip better. It's going to be about making batteries better. That's what this next decade of technology is going to be about, is how do we create energy solutions for storage and solar and climate? And how do we continually innovate batteries so we can solve climate change? Because really the key to solving climate change is in the batteries. And so, and being able to do it in scale and with having the raw materials to do it in a reasonable cost.
Yeah.
So these are incredibly challenging feats that Tesla's now trying to do. And I think within 2 years, they'll succeed. And what we'll see is cars that cost much less, that go much further and faster and are better than the current generation of Teslas. It'll be like 2.0.
Sure. Are you concerned at all about like how dependent Tesla's plans for next year are on 4680 production ramp? Meaning, for example, they have a Berlin Gigafactory that's going to be producing Model Y, right? But this is going to be the new Model Y with the 4680 cells, the structural, pack. And also Austin, they're going to need these probably 4680 cells. And then Cybertruck is going to be dependent. Right. Without 4680 cells in large quantities, how are these factories going to get up and running? Does that concern you at all? Or do you think Tesla knows what they've got it all covered?
I think it's both. I think it concerns me because, as we said earlier, they tend to botch everything for a little bit before they make it way better. But on the other hand, they've been doing this for some time. Like they've been working on these cells for some time. And so I'm pretty optimistic that they'll be able to launch both factories with the technology the way they have envisioned it. And I think it's a game changer. But that's the risk reward with Tesla. That's the risk, is execution risk. And the reward is if they're successful, it's going to be huge for Tesla.
I want to leave kind of or conclude this interview with this one idea, one thought. What are you excited the most about regarding Tesla in the year 2021? What kind of, and more specifically, what do you think people aren't understanding about Tesla? And what will maybe perhaps surprise people about Tesla in 2021?
Well, actually 2021 is kind of a transition year for Tesla because they're going to be increasing, production in China, and we'll see, I think, very good production numbers, but it's really the year of ramping up for the launch of the Cybertruck and Semi and Berlin and Texas getting completed in 2021 is really the main goal. So production can begin at the end of 2021 and into 2022. So I would argue 2022 is a way more interesting year for Tesla as they now launch new vehicles. But 2021 is going to be another one of those transition years where, you know, fortunately we estimate their car sales will be up like 50, maybe 60%. So that's incredible on its own right. But I think that's really the story as they continue to build the gigafactories, and then full self-driving is really going to be a lot of the spotlight next year as they roll it out and improve it. And as they start to build the, I think, amazing vibe that they'll get from society and people as they actually see these cars work in the real world, driving around on their own. So I think, you know, next year is going to be an exciting year for Tesla, but I think 2022 is actually what I'm most excited for, where they'll get to well over a million cars and have a truck line being launched, and then also have the European lines being launched. Like, wow, what an exciting couple of years for Tesla. So I think 2021, I'm actually investing heavily in battery technology. So that's what I learned from Elon and Tesla, was that there needs to be an incredible increase in the amount of capacity in the battery technology area to serve the needs of all the other players. And there are only three companies that make battery cells at this point on any scale of any quality. And, you know, these are foreign companies. And now Tesla's the only domestic cell manufacturer in the United States, but Panasonic is Japanese and LG Chem is, I think, Korean, and then CATL is Chinese. So we like these businesses making cells, being involved with battery technology, because Tesla has succeeded in, you know, moving forward sustainable transportation, and we want to be able to profit off all the other companies now jumping on the Tesla bandwagon and wanting to build EVs, and there's a lot of money to be made. So there's, I still think, an enormous opportunity in Tesla, even though the valuation already supports that, but I think it's a longer term investment. But on the short term, there's a lot of opportunity investing in this technology, in batteries and storage and commodities involved with it. So I think it's an exciting year for climate change and EVs, as well as the technologies around EVs and solar as well.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Ross, I want to thank you for taking this time out, being generous with your insights, and want to wish you the best for the holidays. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll continue the
chat. Really enjoy it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You too.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Bye.